This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1023, a conversation with Al Milgram. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. This is episode 1023. I'm your host, Adam Chapman, and this is yet another conversation with Al Milgram. He was previously on the show in episode 1013 from November. That was the first weekend of November. Last time we talked up until the early 80s. This time we kind of took the conversation from that point forward, talking a lot about Marvel stuff. So there's a lot of really good stuff in here that I really enjoy talking to Al about, and I won't spoil anything else because we're going to get right into the episode. You can email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, rate the show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, listen to us on Apple Podcasts, and listen to us on Spotify. One thing I wanted to mention is that there's a lot of interviews hopefully coming up. We have a special one I'm doing next week with Mike Carlin. There's another one that at least tentatively, fingers crossed, is scheduled with Mark Bagley, which I'm very excited about. And for those who've listened to the show for a long time, that was definitely a bucket list item, has not occurred yet. So it could still not happen. But those in theory are two of the upcoming episodes. I think in February or March, we're going to be speaking with Chuck Austin and Pat Olive to talk about Edgeworld Season 2. I did talk a little bit about it with Pat before, but being able to talk with both of them at the same time to celebrate the upcoming release of the trade paperback is extra special. So that's just some of the stuff coming up. Also, we're going to be resuming Book of the Month Club. We're going to be making our way through the Clone Saga soon, although first we're likely going to do what was happening in Amazing Spider-Man in the months leading up to the Clone Saga. But that'll, be something to look forward to in the coming weeks. Thanks again for listening to this episode, and I hope you enjoy this conversation with Al Milgram. Enjoy. Al, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans Podcast. Thanks for taking the time today.
Well, thanks for having me back, I guess. I don't know if I did this last time, but let me mention if people might be interested in getting commissions, they can contact me. I'll give you my email address. Can I do that now?
Yes, please do.
All right, thanks. I never remember to commercialize or monetize this stuff. So it's Al Milgram. I did a ton of work back in the day, a ton of work. Mm-hmm. And my email address is editorial4@AOL.com. That's editorial, and then the number 4, not spelled out, numeral 4, mm-hmm. At AOL.com. And if you write me, please, in the subject header, say, interested in a commission, and then I'll know you're not trying to give me a computer virus. And I can, if you're interested, I can give you rates and so on and so forth. So, I think my rates are relatively reasonable. So if you're interested, write me a letter. Okay, now, what shall we talk about today?
Well, now I want to ask about your commissions. I'm curious, what's the most, frequent or popular commission you get asked for in terms of a character?
I would say, I get a lot of Thanos commissions because I don't think Starlin draws very many commissions, if any. Very, very few, and some of the ones I've seen him do are very, very loose sketches. Jim likes to do finished stuff. He's not a big fan of doing quick, sketches. So I do a lot of Thanos heads or figures. I've probably done, I don't know how many recreations of the first Black Cat cover on this Amazing Spider-Man 194. Mm-hmm. I've done several full-sized recreations, some in color. I've done sketch cover, books, the ones with the blank covers.
Oh, yeah.
I've done several of those of that cover. I've even done, I think, one on a on a little sketch card, you know, like trading card size.
Oh, yeah.
So I've done those, and one guy actually commissioned me to do a reimagination of that cover. If I was doing it today, what might I do? And I did a what I thought was kind of a nice drawing, completely different from the original. And I actually, sell copies of that, posters, when I go to conventions. So it's got the same cover copy, but the figures are completely different. It doesn't have the prison background.
Mm.
It's more straight, and you know, just a design kind of thing of the two of them on, you know, sort of treading on a little pathway of webbing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is like the one of the more kind of unique or out there ideas that people have asked you for commissions for? I'm always curious about those, the ones that kind of stretch you more.
Well, I think that reimagining that cover was one of the more unusual ones.
Yeah.
I have done a number of cover recreations for a guy out on the West Coast who's just bought dozens and dozens from me, from me inking Starlin and me inking Ed Hannigan. As far as uniqueness goes, let me think. Somebody commissioned me to do, might be the same guy, I can't remember. But when I did the Guardians of the Galaxy way back in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
I penciled the cover for my first issue, which was Marvel, Presents, maybe? I don't remember the title, but it was Marvel, you know, Presents or Marvel Premiere, featuring the Guardians of the Galaxy. It was the third issue of that title because I was running late on my deadline, really. And some guy who had some kind of gem, Bloodstone.
So oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I drew the cover in pencil tightly, and for some reason I had to go out of town for a while. And when I came back, John Romita had redrawn the whole cover and inked it, and that was the cover that appeared on that first appearance of the Guardians issue that I drew. And I don't know why. He never told me. I never asked him. I was curious. I would have liked to know, because he actually drew the same layout. I mean, he used my layout, and it was like, Starhawk and Vance Astro, and then the other guys. It was Martin X and mm-hmm. Yondu and Charlie 27. Those guys. And he took the two characters that I had drawn on the left and put them on the right, and the two characters I'd drawn on the right he put on the left. So he used almost virtually, the same my layout. But reverse the position of those figures. And I don't know why. There was no apparent reason why the color scheme would show up better that way, or I just don't know why he chose to change that element. He used all the same figures, but on different sides of the cover. So I always wondered about that. So somebody committed. I still had my original pencils, and somebody asked if I would do an inked version of it, which I subsequently did, and for a fee, and he got that inked version. I still have the pencils because I inked it on a light box, so
oh, yeah.
I could keep my original pencils, and he could get his original inked version of it. There's a guy or several maybe out there who do these 60 second later or 30 second later covers. You mm-hmm. familiar with those?
Yeah.
Was that a yes or no?
It was a yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, he'll take a cover from the olden days or whenever and say, okay, what would follow immediately after this, this version of it?
Mm-hmm.
And I did a version of that for him. I just thought it was sort of an interesting exercise of my Captain Marvel number 50 cover, which was Captain Marvel and the Avengers and the Super Adaptoid. And it was a good cover. I thought it was one of my better covers, but it had all those characters, which is fun. But in the next scene that I did 30 seconds later, it's like the original was a little static in that they were all poised and posed. But the next one, I did more of an action thing where Captain Marvel's being like, he's being hit by the super adaptoid and flying towards the reader, and everybody else is getting scattered by the blow from the super adaptoid. I thought that was sort of interesting and fun. Other than that, let me see, anything really unique? No, usually people want, you know, they want a good, solid pinup of the characters they enjoy.
Mm.
That's probably as wild as it gets.
Going back for a second, when you mentioned that story about with John Romita, I'm curious, yeah. in general, I mean, I would imagine that, did that happen, type of thing happen often, or did it happen often to you? I mean, obviously, you know, you had things that would be needed to be corrected sometimes, or that he would do as art director. How many instances did you have where, you know, a cover of yours would be modified?
Well, you know, John was the art director, and mm-hmm. Look, I'm not saying John's a much better artist than I'll ever be, and so he did a really nice job, and it was a great cover, but it was basically just my design. Mm-hmm. And, you know, somewhat better drawn, because John draws better than I do. But, you know, when you do the interior, you like to do the cover, too. You know, you feel sort of a proprietary, connection to it. You want to do a cover for your own books. And John was one of their top cover guys for many years, before he even became art director. But he would take it on himself to change stuff or fix stuff. In quotation marks. I didn't begrudge him, because I thought that was his job, and I respected him. I liked John a lot. He was a sweet guy and a terrific artist, and he was always happy to sit there and tell you, you know, how to do stuff better or give you some instruction. but he got into the mindset where he couldn't think of not wanting to fix stuff. Hmm. I remember one time I brought in a Doctor Strange cover I had done that I was very proud of and happy with, and I said, "Hey, John, what do you think of this Doctor Strange cover?" And I was, you know, I just sort of wanted my friend John Romita to say, "Oh yeah, you did a really nice job on this one, Al." But instead, he says, "Well, you know what I would have done? I would have had this happen here, and you could have done this." I said, "No. I wasn't looking for corrections. I just was proud of the cover, and I wanted to show it to you." And he says, "Oh yeah, no, you did a good job." You know, and it was that. He was really in the mindset of, how can I make this better? And he might have been able to make it better, but, you know, damn it, I wanted to do it the way I wanted to do it. So, and, you know, but he would often correct faces in particular. He seldom did wholesale makeovers, but like that Jim Starlin cover, I don't remember the issue number, but it was Captain Marvel. He's flying towards the reader with in outer space with his, you know, his crackly stream of energy, you know, whatever it was behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jim had drawn a Jim Starlin face, as you would expect, on Captain Marvel. And it went into the office. And then when it got published, it was a John Romita face on Captain Marvel. And, Jim had drawn a sort of a gaunt, somewhat hollow-cheeked looking Captain Marvel, and John did a very, you know, glamorous, you know, surfer dude looking kind of Captain Marvel. And if you know, I'm sure that 99% of the people who saw the cover didn't think anything of it. They probably didn't realize that it was two separate artists, and that, you know, that somebody else had redrawn the head.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I know Jim wasn't happy with it. I know I wasn't happy with it. And, you know, we sort of said, you know, John, why? And he says, well, he wasn't handsome enough. I said, okay. And he says, yeah, Stan wouldn't have liked that. So a lot of the times, I think John in his head was trying to anticipate what Stan would or wouldn't like on a cover and fix it accordingly. This was before Stan even saw the cover and had a chance to say, I don't like the head. So he may have very well been right. You know, he worked with Stan for many years. He understood Stan's likes and dislikes for the most part. And, you know, I have no doubt that, you know, 9 times out of 10, Stan, you know, would have been happier with a John's reworking of something than whatever you know, the original was. But you know, the artist didn't like it. You know, nobody likes having their stuff redrawn. I remember this was one that I thought was funny, where John, who was it? Oh, yeah, Gray Morrow, who's a fabulous artist, fabulous. He was a comic book artist. He did paperback book cover illustrations, a terrific draftsman, and just, you know, very gifted. Not the most dynamic guy, but he drew beautifully and fairly realistically. And he really had it down to kind of a science, too. He did a Captain America story in, I don't remember if it was Captain America or Tales, which one was he in? Tales of Suspense, I think?
Yes.
Which one did he have half the book with Iron, was it, no, Iron Man and Cap? Is that right?
I think that's right, yeah. I guess it was Tales of Suspense, yeah.
Suspense, yeah, I think that's right. So, they all kind of run together in my head these days. But so Gray Morrow did this Captain America story. I don't remember the plot, but John got hold of it, and he redrew a great many of the Captain America heads. And, you know, and he did a fine John Romita job. But on the other hand, it didn't look anything like the figures or the other heads that Gray Morrow, who was a brilliant artist in his own right, did. And I went to him and I said, you know, John, I'm just curious, why, you know, Gray Morrow is a really good artist. Oh, yeah, he's fabulous. I said, why did you think you needed to redraw all the Captain America heads? And he said to me, and this was totally, you know, with a straight face, he was not, he said, you know, Al, he did, but he drew it, you know, he drew him so realistically. He says, I was afraid the kids wouldn't recognize who the character was. And I said, John, he's got a red, white, and blue costume. He's got stripes. He's got stars. He's got wings on his helmet. Who the hell else could it have been, you know? And he said, well, yeah, I know what you mean, but I just didn't think, you know, there was no dissuading him. So, you know, that was his rationale. It worked for him. Maybe it worked for Stan. I honestly don't think it was necessary. But John also came from the old school where, you know, they wanted you to work on model as much as possible. It's like the Disney studios. Mm-hmm. Mickey Mouse is going to look like Mickey Mouse no matter what, you know, how many hundreds of different guys draw him. It's going to have to look like the way the model sheets look. The thing about comic books, you know, at least by that point, and certainly now, they don't care if the character looks the same issue to issue. In fact, a lot of times I think they celebrate the differences. If you have Jack Kirby draw, you know, Captain America, or if you have Kevin Nolan draw Captain America, or Steve Ditko draw, you know, there's a thousand different styles. One is not necessarily better than the other, except as a matter of taste. Mm-hmm. You know, who do you like better? And the comic fans really enjoy the different styles, and they don't get, you know, pissy about, oh, it's not consistent. They kind of celebrate the inconsistency of the various styles. So, you know, in that respect, and speaking again of John, I remember talking with him one time. I told him how much I liked his work on when he took over Spider-Man. And obviously, he had taken over right after Ditko left. He got pissed, as Ditko would, and he ran over to DC and he did the Creeper and the Hawk and the Dove, and ultimately, you know, Shade, the Changing Man. Some very interesting, unique, and Ditko-esque characters with varying degrees of success. But when John took over the Spider-Man title, I said, you know, I really like what you did here. I said, you were sort of, you know, trying to mimic Ditko. He said, oh, yeah, because, you know, in the old days, you know, when you took over a strip from another artist, and he's probably thinking more of newspaper strips than actually comic books, but still, he says you would try to, you didn't want it to be a jarring change for the reader. You wanted to keep it in the same stylistic approach, and he had clearly studied Ditko. His inking approach on those was very influenced by Ditko, the way he outlined things and the way he put little like sort of hash mark accents for texture and for you know just for depth on the figures and so on. And he really he doesn't draw like Ditko, but he really did a good job of making the finish Ditko adjacent. I mean, it was very much in the Ditko style and approach. And then gradually, you know, he let his own style come out, and his own style was slicker and more polished than Ditko, and everybody was prettier. The girls were far, far prettier. Ditko never drew, you know, pretty girls particularly. But the boys were prettier, too. I mean, you know, Peter went from being a geeky kid, high school kid, to being, you know, kind of a matinee idol-looking kid. And over time, somehow he lost the need to wear his glasses. So, you know, he didn't even have those you know, geek element glasses going on for him. And, you know, the book, according to Stan, I think became more popular than it ever had been before. And I could believe that's possible. I think Steve's, you know, if you're an art fan, if you know comic book artists, Steve is one of the top all-time comic book artists. But his style can be off-putting. And it had a little bit of a sort of a grotesqueness to it, a little ugliness to it, but in a beautiful way, if that's not too weird a way to put it. The thing I liked about Steve is Spider-Man moved like nobody else, and nobody else, you know, drew him. He had something about the way he had him move was spidery. Like when you see a spider on the wall or, you know, scurrying across a floor or something, there's a creepiness to it that Steve captured in the character. And I'm not sure, you know, anybody else could have done it as well as he did. He really had a unique way of doing it. Plus, Steve did some of the all-time great covers and splash pages in the history of the business. I mean, even back in the late 50s, early 60s, and earlier in the 50s when he was working for other companies, his splash pages, you know, were just wonderful, beautifully designed, eye-catching, intriguing. You know, you couldn't ask for better splash pages. And I understand he was one of Stan's favorite guys to work with, partly because of that, partly because his storytelling was so good. You look at the old, before they became superhero books, Tales to Suspense and Tales to Astonish and Journey into Mystery, and, you know, Steve would be one of the backup guys. Kirby would do the lead feature, but, you know, and then, you know, Don Heck would do one of the backups. Don was a very good artist from the 50s and through the 60s and the sweetest guy you'd ever want to meet. And Steve would do the other backup, and Steve's, you know, they'd always be great. And of course, that's why Stan teamed up with him to do, you know, when it became Amazing Adult Fantasy or whatever that title was that ultimately spawned Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, it was all those little 5 and 6 page short stories that the two of them would do together. And I can't say every, because I don't really remember every, but virtually every splash page was a gem. And then the stories that followed were beautifully drawn, beautifully paced, you know, wonderful storytelling, nice and, you know, creepy and eerie and not Vampirella. So they were wonderful little, you know, stories. And the splash pages were just even another, you know, notch above what Steve did on the interior stuff. Great stuff.
I wanna jump in for a second. So last time we kind of got up to...
I'm talking here. No, I'm kidding.
Right?
Yeah, go ahead.
We got up to the kind of the early 80s last time, but one thing I was looking through a lot of the covers that you had done, and I think now they're probably going to get kind of re-exposed because some of that material is finally being reprinted, and I wanted to ask you about was your long, long run of doing covers for Rum, the Space Knight, which obviously had been languished for a long time at not being able to be reprinted, and now finally Marvel is going to be reprinting these in omnibus collections, and all your colors and their, sorry, your covers in their, you know, in their glory are going to be reprinted. What was it like being the consistent cover artist for so long. Obviously, you were editing, you know, or I guess at sometimes you had your assistant editor doing it, but, you know, you were in charge of that book. So what was it like doing those covers at the same time?
Well, thank you for mentioning them. I'm glad to hear they're going to be reprinting them. I hope the hell they send me a copy, because those omnibuses, they're, you know, they don't throw them around very, you know, they're very expensive. I get it. Mm-hmm. But I do a lot of work on that. You know, I did a lot of covers, as you say. I'll tell you what spawned that. We were getting a lot of negative mail. Did I mention this last time? I don't remember. But we were getting negative mail from fans who were complaining that Marvel shouldn't be doing licensed material. Mm. They should only do their own characters and their own creations. And, you know, it bothered them that we were doing, and we were doing a lot of them because, you know, we were by then probably the major publisher. I think we'd outstripped DC by then. And so people who wanted to have their products, you know, hyped by Marvel would come to Marvel and have us do stuff. And my attitude was, we're a publishing house. If we can make money doing Star Wars, which apparently saved the company, mm-hmm. which I was not aware of at the time, but, you know, George Lucas came to us. He was a comic fan. He said, hey, I'm coming out with this new movie. It's called Star Wars. Nobody knew what it was. Nobody knew it was going to be a success, and he thought it would be a good idea to get, if there was a Marvel comic that came out a little before the movie, it would help promote the movie, and it would, you know, garner some interest for the movie, and, you know, so cross-promotion kind of thing going on there. And we were doing Godzilla, and we were doing the Shogun Warriors. I don't know whoever got the idea. You know, Godzilla, I could see it. He was a big, mm-hmm. big, long-time franchise, but Shogun Warriors, really? You know, but, you know, there was, I guess it was early in the process where a lot of the Japanese stuff was becoming popular in this country as well. And, you know, so we did Shogun Warriors. I did a number of covers for them, too. And we were doing what? Battlestar Galactica, and mm-hmm. at some point we were doing some Star Trek stuff, and, you know, if we thought it was something we could sell and we could make a profit on it, we would say, sure, why not? You know, we did the Edgar Rice Burroughs stuff at some point also. So when we got the thing to do ROM, the guy came in, the guy who developed the toy. It was a very large, I don't know, it was more than a foot tall, I think. It seemed like it was more than a foot tall. It was a very big plastic toy. And his name, ROM, was, of course, based on the idea that he had a chip in the toy that made five or six distinctly different sounds, you know, like the sound of his ray gun blasting or the sound of his rockets firing, or I don't even, you know, whoop, 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 you know, maybe he sounded like a patrol car pulling you over. I don't remember, but there were a number. And of course, ROM stands for, I didn't know anything about this at the time, but I learned, you know, read only memory, which means it could do a few specific things, but nothing else. You couldn't program it to do anything different than what it was already doing. And so, we called in Bill Mantlow, who was, you know, prolific and very professional and very reliable. And we got Sal Buscema. Same could be said of him, you know. A terrific artist, a terrific storyteller, fast as lightning, you know, always, mm-hmm. always deadline on time. I love working with guys like that. It's nice to work with, you know, artsy-fartsy guys who do beautiful, gorgeous stuff, but don't only do a one issue every 6 months, you know. You can't have a monthly comic with guys like that, so it was nice. You know, I had those two guys working on that, ROM and the Hulk. And here I am being long-winded again, but the bottom line is I wanted to show these naysaying fans that it was fine to do, you know, licensed commercial stuff, and that we could make it just as interesting as our own characters. And I thought I was, you know, I didn't have like a much of an ego, but I had a little bit of an ego. And I was one of the premier cover guys at Marvel at the time. I did a lot of the covers. You know, Gil Kane was doing, you know, 48 covers a month, and then they let me do three or four, you know, that kind of thing. So, and actually I was, well, there's another story. Stop me if I told you this one later. But anyway, the bottom line was I wanted to try to help sell ROM as much as it was within my power, mm-hmm. besides being the editor and, you know, generating, you know, with Bill and Sal, what I hoped would be very good, entertaining stories that the fans would like. So I said, well, I'm going to do covers for this book because, you know, and I tried extra hard to do good covers. And he's a horrible character to draw. He's just clunky looking. He looks like a big plastic toy. He really does. And, you know, I don't know how much flexibility there could be to his figure. But I really remember trying to do the best covers I could. In fact, I did a cover for the first issue. And I think Jim Shooter said, you know, Al, we love your work, but Frank Miller's the hot property right now. He was the big superstar of the moment. Still is, I guess, you know, but and they had Frank redraw the cover, very similar to what I had done, but in his style, obviously. And I don't remember who inked it. I think it might have been Rubenstein. I don't remember. Might have been Klaus. I'm not sure. But I drew the cover. They said they paid me, and they said we're not using it. We're going to use Frank's. Figuring that Frank, being the superstar, people would buy it just for his cover. And they were probably right. But then I did several covers after that. And then I got Michael Golden to do several covers. And mm-hmm. And then I did a lot more covers myself. I don't remember offhand, you know. I did as many as I could or wanted to. I got Ed Hannigan, who was a terrific designer of covers. He did several, many of which I inked. And the book sold well and had a very nice, long, respectable run. What did it run, 70, 80 issues, something like that?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, which is 6-7 years. So and we had a nice, long run on that book. And the Micronauts, which was another Bill man. Bill brought that one to Marvel. His daughter liked playing with the Micronauts toys. And he said, hey, I think this would be another good property for us. And, I don't know, we convinced the powers that be. And I'm surprised, actually, because Shooter was not a big fan of Bill's work and didn't necessarily want to encourage him. But nonetheless, somebody said, yeah, these look like cool characters. And of course, so we did the Micronauts, and I didn't do covers for the Micronauts, but we did get Michael Golden, who's even better than I am. So, Golden, here was a massively talented artist working with Bill. I think Rubenstein was inking it at first. I remember we had the worst newsprint paper. I mean, you could actually, the drawing from one side of the page was bleeding through to the other side. This beautiful Mike Golden artwork, and you could see it through the other side of the page. It was terrible, but at least it was, you know, it was as good as we could do. And then I remember McLeod inked one issue, and that was beautiful. And then I'm not sure why, but, you know, I said, you know what? I don't know if Bob wasn't available for more, or I just said, I'd like to try inking this guy's stuff. And I did. I inked it for 5 issues, I think, from 9, 10, 11, 12, and then 9, 10, 11, 12. Maybe just the 4 issues? I don't remember. But that sounds right. 4 issues. And, you know, Golden is doing his, you know, these beautiful, gorgeous, well-designed, beautifully drawn covers. And that book, and then, you know, we had to get Chaykin. Actually, I got Chaykin to draw the book for several issues, and I kept inking it, and I was trying to sort of, as John Romita had taught me, mimic the Golden look to the stuff on Chaykin's layouts. I did not do a real successful job. It was, you could see it. You could see where I was trying to do it, but... And Howard's a brilliant artist in his own right, but he was doing it, and I was inking it. It didn't really look like Golden. It didn't really look like Chaykin. It maybe looked more like me. I remember thinking at the time, I remember at some point Howard let slip that he actually, he was supposed to be doing the breakdowns for it, the layouts, and I was doing finishes maybe. But actually, Alan Kupperberg was laying it out for Howard, and then Howard was, turning it into tighter breakdowns, and then I was inking it. So there were layout things going on behind the scenes I wasn't even aware of until he let it slip. But nonetheless, and then we found some other artists who took over who did some really nice stuff on it. I don't even remember now. I think did Butch Geist do a run on it, and maybe Armando Gill did a run on it, maybe as an inker. I don't remember if he penciled. I don't know. We found a bunch of guys. Gil Kane, I think, did a long run on it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But that book too had a nice 70 or 80 issue run, and to this day, they had trouble reprinting that one too, because the rights had lapsed exactly, but because, well, they had, but also half the characters were Mego, was that the toy company?
Yeah, that's right.
Mego, they own several of the characters, but then Bill created several new characters. I think possibly Bug and Marionette,
mm-hmm.
And I don't remember exactly what the breakdown was. But and those characters were conversely and perversely, perhaps, owned by Marvel. So once Marvel was no longer doing it, and the license lapsed, nobody could do reprints because both companies had rights to various characters and they couldn't play together. Come on, you guys, it's a big sandbox. People would like to see it reprinted. We can all make some money here. No. We don't want to make money that way. So I businesses, am I right? Corporations,
right?
They're all crazy.
Well, I guess
I know Marvel and DC got together to do Superman, Spider-Man. You'd think anybody else could get along for 5 minutes to do reprints of that stuff, and ultimately they did.
Yeah, it's interesting to finally see. I mean, I know people have wanted the Micronauts stuff for so long, and now, again, Marvel's putting out an omnibus of that in April, and I think the ROM one, the first volume, comes out this month even. So, I mean, for people who love that stuff and have been trying to collect it for all these years, finally, there's going to be an easier way to do that.
Yeah. Now, well, good. I should see some reprint money then. I'm happy.
I want to jump forward. A collaboration I'm very curious about, just because he's a big friend of the show, is your collaborations with Ron Frenz over the years, specifically, in the latter bit of his Thor run, as well as working on Thunderstrike. I'm curious what your relationship was with Ron and doing inks over his pencils.
Well, yes, I did. I had a very long and happy collaboration with Ron and also Tom DeFalco in all those instances, I believe.
Yep.
I was never Ron's first choice, as I'm almost never anybody's first choice. But what would happen is Ron, I remember he was doing Thor, and they were getting Don Heck to ink him.
Mm.
And Don, again, I think Don was a terrific artist, I think underappreciated, because, he was like the... he was like the third or fourth guy in the Marvel chain of talent. Kirby, was the top guy. Ditko was the second guy. And then they had Dick Ayers and Don Heck. And, there were others, but those were the big four.
Hmm.
And, in the 50s, he did horror stuff. He did crime stuff. He did, detective stuff. And he was highly regarded, and, I can't remember, probably it was Harvey Comics. He did a lot of covers for, really nice horror covers. And he was like their cover guy, and he was like, and he did a lot of interiors. But by the 60s, he was the guy they brought in when Kirby couldn't draw every single comic Marvel was publishing. And I think he did a fine, creditable job, and I like his work. I think it's appealing and has a nice warmth to it, and he draws very attractive women. But nobody draws action like Kirby, and nobody composes like Ditko. And Gary Groth at the Comics Journal used to like to insult him for some reason whenever he had the chance. Anyway, off the topic. Don was inking Ron's stuff, And Ron said, you know, look, I love Don's work, but I don't like him inking me. It's true. He would ink very much like he would ink his own stuff, Don. You know, and it was the Don Heck inking approach over the Ron Friend's pencils that Ron was not entirely happy with. And so they said, look, we're going to find Don something else to do. Don't worry about that. But would you be interested in inking Ron on Thor? And I said, sure. And I love Ron's pencils. And the other, you know, Ron is another guy, I think, to a certain extent, is underappreciated. Because his style is really good. It's terrific storytelling, terrifically dynamic. His composition, everything is good. The only possible negative is that his stuff is, it's not as unique as it could be. I hope I don't hurt his feelings by saying that. He may realize it. He probably does. His stuff is very much influenced by Kirby and Ditko and the Buscema brothers. And he's, you know, he's got elements of all of them, sort of an amalgam in his style. And because it's not a unique style, because it's more, he is like, to me, like the ultimate Marvel artist from the next generation. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's not Kirby and it's not John Buscema, but you know, 5 years later, it's the best of all those guys combined. And I loved inking his stuff. And even more than that, I found it easy to ink. He was very reliable. I helped him get his first job. I'll go into that in a minute. But also, he did blue pencils rather than, you know, regular number two pencils. And he would do drawings that he insisted were breakdowns, which means they were looser than full pencils. It's what both the Buscema brothers did in the vast majority of their careers were breakdowns. Mm-hmm. And they could do five or more pages a day of breakdowns. And then what happens with breakdowns is the penciler would get $25 less per page, and the inker would get that $25 added to his inking fee for doing finishes over the breakdowns.
Okay.
And Ron insisted that his stuff was breakdowns. And I said, Ron, they're not breakdowns. They're full pencils. You know, even where there's no, where you don't fill in the black areas with your pencil, you'll put X's, which is the shorthand in comic book illustration, for this area should be filled in black. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I would actually argue and fight with him a little bit. You know, it wasn't really antagonistic. But no, Ron, really, these are full pencils. Why don't you vouch for them as full pencils? No, Al, the covers I'm doing are full pencils. These are breakdowns. I know the difference. So he insisted. So as a result, I got an extra $25 a page for inking pages that I thought were full pencils anyway. So, you know, not only do I enjoy inking his stuff immensely, but I got paid extra for doing it. So, you know, nothing wrong with me. Look, I'm trying to make a living, you know, as based on the amount of work I did, you can imagine that was at least part of my motivation. Look, who doesn't like making extra money or making a good living? But also, I had a hunger for doing as much work as I could. I had wanted to be in comics my whole life. Not that much of a life at the time, you know. I was in my 20s, now I was in my 30s in the 80s. And I wanted to work on everything and anything that they had, and I was working to full capacity most of my career. And I also, and I felt bad if anybody, they offered anybody else a job. You know, I was like, why couldn't I have done that? Well, Al, you're doing five books now. Well, okay, you know. So, you know, and I would do my, you know, whatever, my two or three maybe monthly books, and of course help out whenever I could. If they had a jam, Al, we got four pages, we got to get inked right away because the book's late, and if you don't, and I would help out every opportunity. Did I tell you the story of the Romitas taking my work into the office last time?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, no, really?
I don't think so.
All right, well, forgive me if I'm being redundant. I was living on Long Island, as were the Ramitas, and so I had the advantage that very few or no other freelancers had. I could, and this is when I was not on staff. This is when I was back to freelancing full-time.
Okay.
They would call me up and say, Al, we got two pages. We've got to get them back, like, immediately. And I'd say, okay. And they'd FedEx them to me. So I'd get them at 10 o'clock in the morning, let's say Tuesday. I'd get the two pages, and I could ink two pages a day, and sometimes more, depending. I often had a background help as well. But because of if it was a dire emergency, I couldn't get the pages to my background guy. Sometimes, like, but what I could do was 10 in the morning, I'd sit down at the board, I'd work all day long, have dinner with my family, and then I'd go back to the board, I could work all night long. So it ended up being essentially two work days. So if I had to do two, three, even four pages, I could conceivably get them done and then drive over to the Romita's house, which was 15 or 20 minutes from my house, and I'd slip a manila envelope in their back door. And they would then go into the office. They drove into the office every day, and they'd take it in for me. So I would get pages on a Tuesday, and the office could get them back on a Wednesday. And, you know, and they go, how did he do that, you know? And the answer was, I couldn't have done it if the Ramitas hadn't been, you know, ferrying the stuff back and forth for me. So I had the little-known and seldom used, except by me, Ramita Express at my... beck and call.
That's great. You mentioned that you helped Ron Frenz get his first gig.
I did. And let me give credit where credit is also due. Jim Shooter came back from a convention in Pittsburgh, I believe. And he brought with him some samples by this Ron Frenz fella. I don't remember the year. And he said, hey, you know, I met this guy at this convention and he's pretty good. Can we use him? And I looked at the stuff and I said, he's very good. We certainly can use him, but, you know, nobody needs anybody, you know, at the moment. And Ron at the time was doing animation work. And in fact, he was involved with, I'm going to probably get this wrong. What was that one that was sort of like based on a, I don't know, was it Stephen King stuff? And they did a movie with multiple short stories.
Oh, I can't think of it.
Creepshow.
Okay, there you go.
Creepshow. Yeah, it came to me eventually. And so there were these samples, and I put them in my drawer. And at some point, Wheezy, Louise Simonson, said, oh, I've got an issue. I misremember this. I thought she needed help on a Kazar, but I think before that, oh, maybe she needed Kazar first. She needed help. She needed somebody to do a fill-in issue of Kazar because whoever was doing it at the time was late or behind or couldn't do it. I said, you know, I've got these pages by this guy that Shooter found, and I think he's really good, and he's a professional, so I don't know how he'd do. And they were comic book, I think, style pages.
Mm-hmm.
Says, well, why don't you, you know, you want to give him a call? And, you know, I don't know if I called him or Wheezy called him first, but she, you know, she said, look, I need an artist for an issue of this. Can you do it? And he said, sure. And he did. He turned it around in, you know, reasonable time, and he did a terrific job. And I don't remember who wrote it or who inked it, but, you know, next thing you know, he's working for Marvel full-time. And the next thing I remember seeing from him was a Star Wars issue with a splash page with Darth Vader that'll just knock your eyes out. It was just a beautiful, beautiful job. And then he was off and running, so I take credit for him, even though it was really Shooter and me and Wheezy. And then, you know, it turned out to have been a good move on my part because I got to ink thousands of his pages later.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm curious.
And with a bonus rate, so.
Yeah, exactly. I'm curious when you did take over the you know, working on Thor with him and then launching Thunderstrike, I mean, what kind of shorthand were you guys kind of able to, like, would you guys talk at all about, you know, what you would do in terms of some of the inks, or was was it just on the page and then you just elaborated on what was there?
Really, and this is a regret of mine, Ron and I, although friendly, are not close. We never hung out together. I would call him up and, you know, if I had a question about something in the pencils, which was very rare because they were tight and beautiful and unmistakable. But he and Tom had a very close working relationship, still do. They would bounce ideas off each other. I think that Ron contributed a lot to the plotting and I think, you know, I wasn't there. I wasn't privy to it, but my impression is they worked very well and very closely together. And basically when they were done, they'd send it to me. And I had no input into the plots. I was happy to just be getting the pages and inking them and keeping as busy as I could with all the other stuff. And aside from the Thor, when I took over Thor, there were other things that Ron did, and almost invariably, he would get, now I'm having an old man mental break. Brett
Breeding.
Breeding, thank you. I know Brett, and I like Brett, and I shouldn't forget his name, but blame it on my age, Brett, if you're out there. Brett Breeding would start inking some series that Ron was involved in. I can't think of any offhand specifically, unless he did the early Thunderstrikes. Did he? I don't know.
No, I think you did.
I did. I did all of them. All I know is that Brett would ink an issue or two or three. And then they'd say, Al, Brett's falling behind. Can you finish this half an issue that he didn't get to? And I'd say, sure. And then they'd say, Al, you want to take over the book? And I said, well, I don't want to take the book away from Brett. And he did beautiful work, and beautiful work over Ron. But he does beautiful work anyway. Beautifully polished, finished stuff. Very, Jerry Ordway looking stuff. Mm-hmm. Nice polish, nice finish. Kind of Tom Palmer-y looking. A little less organic maybe than Palmer's stuff, but beautiful in that he knew how to do the rendering and the double lighting and stuff like that. Anyway, so I didn't want to take work away from him, but they said, no, we'll get stuff for him, but, you know, he just can't keep up with a monthly book, and would you like to take the book over? And I said, I'm there, you know, I'm as always. And Ron would then and I'd have a fight with Ron about whether he was doing breakdowns or full pencils, and he would always say, nope, they're breakdowns, and I'd say, I would capitulate, and then I'd go home and count the extra money. So that was about the way that worked. But I think Brett was always his first choice, and I can't blame him, and I was always his second choice, and I was happy with that because I ended up getting all the work anyway, so... my ego might have been a little bruised, but my bank account was healthier.
So, as I said, like Ron is a close friend of the show, so I think he's done, 10 or 11 interviews with me for the show, so he's put in his time. A book that I have always loved, that actually went very deep on it with Ron in the past, which you've actually inked 8 of the 12 issues, was A Next from the late 90s. And so that was...
Who did the first 2 issues?
The first 4 issues were by Brett. And then it was you for the remaining 8.
Yeah, now there you go. The pattern continues.
So, do you have any particular? I mean, you've inked everything, right? But do you have any particular memories of working on A Next with Ron?
Just that I was very happy to be getting into work at the time because Bob Harris was definitely trying to force me out of Marvel. I don't know if he didn't like me or didn't like my work or just didn't like the fact that I wasn't one of the hot young Turks drawing the X-Men, and he was definitely trying to force me out. And luckily he apparently couldn't bully DeFalco. And so DeFalco said, yeah, we want Al to ink it. And I don't know what the circumstances were, but maybe he didn't care enough about the, Marvel Next generation stuff to care, but he allowed me to stay on that book, and then I was doing also thanks to Tom, I ended up inking Ron Lim on
J2.
J2 and Wild Thing.
Okay. I didn't know if it was both, but I knew it was some of the J2 stuff for sure.
I know at some point I was doing that, and then at some point Ron did not Daredevil, but Dark Devil, was it maybe?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, and I got to ink some of those, and unfortunately, the only book of those that had a real long run was the Spider-Girl one, and on that one, Ron was being inked by Sal Buscema. Well, I guess, actually, Brett Breeding would have been his first choice. Sal Buscema would have been his second choice, because he loves Sal's work. A lot of his own style was heavily influenced by Sal's stuff, so Sal would have been his second choice. And then I was his third choice, but whatever. and I would have loved that, because at that time I was getting very little, if any, work at Marvel anymore. But I can't begrudge Sal Buscema, who's one of the nicest guys you'll ever want to know, super talented, and probably gets a slightly bad rap only because his last name is Buscema. And instead of saying, that's Sal Buscema, he's great, they keep going, yeah, Sal's good, but his brother, you know. and Sal, of course, is the first guy to say that. You know, he says, oh, John is just the best, and, you know, my stuff is, you know, a pale shadow of his stuff. But that's not true. His stuff has its own qualities, and it's very well drawn, and it's very dynamic, and it's, you know, terrific stuff. And again, if they didn't share the same last name, I think maybe he'd have been held in even higher regard. But I think he is held in high regard anyway. So, and you know, I mean, Sal and John, you think about it, the two of them, they would do breakdowns about 5 pages a day, is my understanding.
Wow.
You know, and they'd get up in the morning, they'd eat their breakfast like good American guys, and they'd go into the studio and they'd work until they got 5 pages done. So during the course of a week, they each drew an entire comic and more, and that's 1 week. So they each were doing 4 books a month, or capable of it,
mm-hmm.
and that's 8 books a month. That could be a whole line. You know, that you could have a publisher publishing 8 books a month. Those two guys could handle it. And then if you had Kirby, who could do that much or more, and Ron Frenz, who could do at least two books a month, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And me and Starlin, you know, guys, I mean, you could have 7 guys and you could have an entire lineup. But anyway, that stuff kept me employed for a while longer, at least.
So I have a curious question. I mean, it's interesting. So, you know, of the three, I guess, MC2 books at the time, you were inking two of them. Ironically, both, you know, inking Ron's in both cases. You got Ron Lim on one and Ron Frenz on the other. What was it like to maintain a visual consistency? Because now you're dealing with the same very specific world. And in the case of J2, he was obviously in both books, and keeping him consistent as well. Did you find trying to, you know, keep that character more on model, so to speak, kind of like a Romita thing, because you're the common thread between the two different artists illustrating this character?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to give you the short answer, which is no. the two Rons both have very good, distinct, and different styles. And, but, you know, again, it's like Gray Morrow drawing Captain America. J2 is J2. He's got the costume. Mm-hmm. He's got the helmet. Of course, there are, like what I said about comic fans not being fussy if the styles are different from one book to another, if it's a different artist, they don't care. As long as it's good, as long as it's good stuff, they're happy with it. And both those guys drew very tight breakdowns, or pencils, depending. You know, I didn't have to do any more than do a nice, solid, slick ink job. And I think that everybody involved, well, at least I hope everybody involved, was happy with the results of that. Nobody ever said, gee, Al, you got to make him look more like he does in this book. That never happened. I mean, the only time I tried to do something like that, probably, well, there were a couple of occasions that I can think of. One was the I just mentioned it earlier. Oh, when I tried to make Chaykin look like Michael Golden, which is a fool's errand, but I tried. And I remember once inking a very early Keith Giffen job. What was the character? I know. You know what? It was Killraven.
Oh, yeah.
And he did an early Killraven story, and the book had been drawn by Craig Russell, who's another really terrific, illustrative artist with a gorgeous drawing and inking style. And so I, you know, took out a couple issues of Killraven, and while I'm inking Keith's pencils, which, again, look absolutely nothing like Craig Russell's, they're good in their own way, but you know, and again, an early job by Keith, and I tried to render it the way Craig Russell rendered his own stuff, and it was with very limited success, I would say. But there was a case where I really tried to make it look like, the artist of record, and I don't think anybody ever said, "Hey, you made it look just like Craig Russell's stuff," because it didn't. But stylistically, it was a little closer to Craig's stuff than it would have been. And perhaps if anybody else had inked it, I don't know, except Craig. Craig could have inked it, probably done a much better job of that. But no, as far as the Marvel Next stuff, I didn't feel it was necessary to try to alter that stuff to make it look more like, you know, any of the other books. They all looked fine.
So you did.
I like working, you like working with good professional pencilers, mm-hmm. where you don't have to think too much. You know, my mentor, Murphy Anderson, who I think I told you the last time, mm-hmm. I worked my first year in the business, I worked for Murph. And he told me, and I may have said this last time, but I'll repeat. He said, "Al, there's only two things you got to worry about, two rules of inking." I said, "Yes, Murphy, what are those?" And he said, "We're paid to ink, not think. And when in doubt, black it out." And neither of those things were tenets that he followed, but I thought they were funny, and I have quoted them ever since in respect to Murphy. And because, we're paid to ink, not think. Nobody thought more about what he was putting on the ink page than Murphy did. I mean, he overthought it, if anything. So I thought that was a funny thing to tell me. And then I think, I added a third tenet to that, which was, I can't ink him if I ain't got him. And that was in reference to the time I went into the office and an editor there said, "Al, when are we going to get those pages?" I can't think of his name. He was the editor on, I may have said this story last time too, so forgive me. What the heck? I always have a hard time remembering his name for some reason.
Which book was it?
It was Punisher War Journal. I was inking it over Jim Lee at the time.
Potts? No.
No. It was some guy who was a flake.
Maybe it's better that we don't know his name then.
No, he was a nice guy. I liked him well enough, but he almost inadvertently screwed me on the deal. Hold on one second, if sure. you don't mind.
Yeah, of course.
Let me find here, the Grand Comics database. Thank you. Now let me look up Punisher War Journal.
That's a great site, by the way. I do miss Comic Book DB, though.
I'm sorry, say it again?
I was just saying, I love the Grand Comics database. It's a great resource. I miss the Comic Book database, or Comic Book DB, that used to be around.
Yeah, my only complaint is it used to be much easier to look stuff up, because now when you go there, there's 12 million listings, and it's like a single issue or a reprint, and to find the original series,
mm-hmm.
you have to go through 12 pages, and it doesn't necessarily get you there anyway.
Yeah.
80 issues in 1988. That sounds like it might be it.
Or you have to filter out a lot of stuff, because I use it a lot. I mean, it's funny, just looking at, pulling up you, and it's like 5,000 listings, but it's including different languages. It's...
Right.
So...
Hold on, here I am. Don Daly.
Okay.
Okay. So I walked into Don's office, and I was just up at Marvel visiting, maybe dropping stuff off or whatever. He says, "When am I going to get those? I haven't gotten any of those War Journal pages back yet." I said, what are you talking about? I don't have any War Journal pages. He goes, what? You're lying. And I said, Don, I don't appreciate that. I'm not lying. I don't have any pages. And he turns to his assistant, and he says, we sent those pages to Al, right? And he goes, oh, yeah, we sent it to him 2 weeks ago. I said, hold on a minute. I never got any War Journal pages. I said, that means one of two things. Either FedEx lost them, or let's just look in your flat files, shall we? And I pulled out the drawer, and there were, sure enough, 12 pages of Punisher War Journal, penciled and lettered, sitting there, and they had not sent them to me. I said, Don, I think you owe me an apology. Does he apologize? No. He turns to his assistant. He says, quick, call up every inker we know. We've got to send pages out, like one, two pages, whatever they can do. I said, wait a minute. You screwed up, and now you're taking a book away from me because you screwed up? But hell, we got to get it done right away. I said, you know, I'm a pretty reliable inker. It's my book. How about this? I said, where's the second half of the book? Well, Jim hasn't turned it in yet. I said, well, Jim hasn't penciled it yet. Why don't you let me take these pages home? I'll get right to work on them. I just dropped off all my other work, so I've got nothing else pending. I said, I'll dig right in. I'll start inking it. And I'll tell you what. If you've got to get the other pages back from Jim, they've got to be scripted and lettered before you send them out. Let me try to get these done. And then, you know, if I get them done, I'll send them in. And then when you get the second, you know, the next batch, you can send them to me. If I'm still working on these and the next batch comes in already, scripted and lettered, mm-hmm. and you need to use some other inkers, I'll understand. But in the meantime, give me a chance to at least do, you know, ink my own book. And he said, well, you know, wrestling with his conscience. Okay. And sure enough, I finished the first half before I ever saw another page of the job. And by the time, and then they'd get, you know, they got maybe, because they were desperate, they probably told the letterer, well, as soon as you have three pages done, send them in to us. And they, you know, send it in, and they'd send it to me, and I'd get them done, and then another three pages. And I ended up inking the entire issue, and I think it was number 12. And, you know, so that was where I added to When in Doubt, Black It Out, We're Paid to Ink That Thing, and the third tenet, I can't ink them if I ain't got them.
I have one more question before I'll let you get back to your day, because I know you've already spent a great amount of time with me.
I don't have much to do, so I'm happy to talk, but go ahead.
Okay. A book that you worked on, not every issue, but a bunch of the issues, I think like four or five of them. I'm just curious about the exercise of working on Fantastic Four World's Greatest Comics magazine, which is kind of a jam book back from 2001 to 2002. You did, you know, in a bunch of those issues, you did four or five pages, which was not irregular because you had a lot of different pencilers and inkers kind of taking part in that process. I'm curious what that was like from you, from an inker perspective. Like, were you given any knowledge about what the other pages were going to look like visually so that you could maintain some stylistic consistency, or what was that approach?
No, I mean, essentially what they were trying to do is a tribute or an homage or outright stealing of, you know, Lee and Kirby stuff, you know, which, let's face it, a lot of people at Marvel have done homages to those guys over the years, and they were trying to, you know, make it look as much like the early Marvel stuff on the FF as they could, and, you know, but apart from that, you know, they used a lot of different guys. Ron was one of them. Ron did some chapters for them. Mm-hmm. I think I inked one or more of his. I think they had Sinnott ink one or more of his. It was a little ironic because, but you know, Ron probably can do as good a Jack Kirby impression as almost anybody. And you'd think that then having him inked by Joe Sinnott, it would be as close as you want to get to Kirby Sinnott. Mm-hmm. But by this time, Joe's stuff had become quite a bit slicker. I remember, like, his early stuff inking Kirby, it was beautiful, it was slick, it was warm. He added some nice draftsman-like touches to Kirby's, you know, slightly abstract, unique style. But it didn't really look like, you know, Kirby, because Joe's inks were so slick at this point. I remember, you know, the first time I ever saw the two of them work together, this is Kirby and Sinnott, was the Fantastic Four number 5, the first appearance of Dr. Doom. And the earlier, the first four issues, I think Dick Ayers inked one or two. I think maybe Saul Brodsky is reported to have done maybe the first issue, which I didn't really know that he was capable of. But since then, I am aware that he did used to draw and ink stuff for Stan in the earlier days, and actually inked a crossword puzzle cover or two that I did for when I was up, you know, working for, you know, for Marvel. They had several other publications besides comics in those days. And just for fun, I don't remember if he asked me or if I asked him, but I did two or three crossword puzzle covers. And Sal inked them, and he did a real nice job. They were simple and cartoony a little bit, but he did a perfectly fine ink job. So anyway, so the that FF number 5, I'm trying to think, they did another early job together too, Kirby and Sinnott, but I can't think of what it was offhand. No, well, whatever. But that one, I could tell it was there was something about that issue that was a step above what the inks had looked like on Kirby's other earlier issues. And I liked the way Dr. Doom looked, and I liked the way the rocks looked better, and the thing looked, everybody looked better. It was just terrific. And it almost reminded me in many ways of Wally Wood, although it was not as slick as Wally Wood, but it was in that sort of Hal Foster approach to inking, and it looked great. And so so when they sent me these pages, I just looked at them and I said, okay, I did my best Joe Sinnott impression, basically, is what I was, I thought, well, this is what they're looking for. And I tried to make it look as much like Kirby inked by Sinnott as I could, but I wasn't going to do any like wholesale redrawing. Nobody asked me to. And I always felt that that was, again, somewhat of a disrespect to the penciler if you tried to make it, look exactly like somebody else. So despite those other couple instances I just cited, with Chaykin and with Keith Giffen. So I said, well, they're trying to do something reminiscent of the earlier FF stuff, and I can do stuff in that vicinity, in that general look, and I did. It was fun. It was a weird project. I don't know what they were thinking, honestly. I don't know exactly what the premise was for that.
Yeah, I guess obviously it came from Larson, but you try to celebrate Stan and Jack, but it is an interesting. It's an interesting oddity, and it kind of it's not bad. It's actually quite enjoyable to read, but it's definitely an interesting choice, especially at the time, 2001 and 2. You would not have expected necessarily to see a book like that.
No, it was very retro. And did Eric write that series?
I believe him and Eric Stevenson did it together.
I don't know Stevenson, but by that time, I don't know if they were still, lettering on the boards either. So it's possible I didn't know what the hell was going on in the stories. That's one of the things I really regret about computer lettering. At least in the old days, when I was inking something, I could read the story as I went along, and I could follow it, later, when it became computerized, I'd be inking stuff, and I wouldn't know what the hell was going on. I didn't know if a character should be, smiling or grimacing or in pain or frowning. You didn't get any of the verbal clues that you used to in the olden days, but that's progress for you. I also think it's a shame. My understanding now is that Marvel does no longer work Marvel style. I'm sure if DeFalco and Ron do anything together, they do it Marvel style, but I think now they work full script, which was one of the few differentiations between them and DC, and I think it's one of the things that really allowed Marvel to overtake and overcome and best DC, because it gave the artist a lot more free range to do stuff visually that were that was more exciting and less restricting than having the entire, you know, the entire script already there and taking up, you know, half the panel, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't believe they work Marvel style anymore. And I think, you know, it's one of the last few differences that separated the companies that now has gone away. The same way DC used to have multiple universes and Marvel only had one universe. Now Marvel has multiple universes and DC only has one. It's just they've been completely reversed their positions, you know. So I don't know if DC still has a multiverse, but they, you know, Crisis on Infinite Earth, didn't everything get combined into one universe?
I mean, yes, but there have been so many crises since then that have reversed that.
Oh, have they? Yeah. Well, that's, you know.
That's comics.
That's comics for you. It, you know, guys can die and come back to life. Universes can, you know, crumble and be resurrected. I guess that's some of the fun of it, but I kind of miss the way it used to be. You know, and you know, it also was a factor that, you know, Marvel was becoming buried under the weight of its own continuity. You know, you couldn't, you know, you start out with, you know, Reed and Ben having, you know, fought in World War II. Well, now, you know, there's hardly a soldier left alive who fought in World War II. You know, there's no way to maintain, you know, and they did a thing with Nick Fury taking some kind of longevity solution that kept him as young as he needed to be along with Captain America. But still, after a while, you just can't maintain it. You can't, if you're going to have the characters live in real time, then you're going to have to age them. And if you age them, you're going to have to kill them. And if you're going to have to kill them, you no longer have characters. So it's a bad process.
No, I suppose so.
I say, you know what? They're fictional characters. Let them be immortal. Who does it hurt?
Hmm. Yeah. That's a good place to end it. But, Al, thank you so much again for being so generous with your time and your stories. And it's always nice to hear your perspective on things and to talk about the books that we've talked about today. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome, and thanks for the plug early in the podcast. And don't forget, if you'd like a nice Al Milgram original, you know, I'm ready and available, and not doing much else these days. And you know, who knows how much more time I've got to do these things? You know, get them while they're hot.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And get them while I'm warm, I guess is the other.
Very dark, all but right, thank man. You.
Yeah, my pleasure. Oh, you know what? Do me a favor. Would you send me link?